This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast featuring weekly interviews with the most brilliant minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is always free of charge, and unlike the mainstream financial press, we're not a platform for market cheerleading. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the business telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Nathan Egger.
Macro Voices Episode 10 was recorded April 14th, 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. By far the best feedback we've received from our first nine shows was on our first two-part special, The Coming Bottom in Oil Prices, featuring Art Berman. We've received a lot of requests also that we do a gold show. But you know, a pet peeve of mine is that all these gold bug podcasts are constantly hyping the same old arguments. And in my opinion, they serve little purpose other than giving the precious metal dealers a platform from which to peddle an old and worn out story of central bank conspiracies to suppress the gold price and how you're almost certain to get filthy rich overnight when the conspiracy fails and your gold is suddenly worth 10 times more. It's an always bullish narrative that seldom changes or even reflects current macroeconomic conditions. I contend that for serious investors, if you want to look at gold as a speculative investment, you need to understand a lot more than just the usual gold bug narrative. You need to know where we stand in the rate normalization process, where the risks of a monetary policy reversal lie, and so on and so forth. It's more of a macro discussion than a precious metals discussion. But even if the macro arguments are compelling, and you decide to go long, you got to decide what to go long. Physical bullion, ETFs like GLD, mining shares, call options? If you want to answer those questions, you're going to have to consider this from the perspective of someone who has serious experience in natural resources speculating. Someone who can talk, for example, to the economic conditions that mining companies are facing right now with the depressed precious metals prices so that you can gauge whether or not they can be profitable and whether they make sense as investment plays. And then, of course, there's the whole question of allocation ratio between gold, silver, and other precious metals, and so forth. So the point is, there's a whole lot to this. It's not as simple as people tend to make it out to be. So to address these needs with a proper Macro Voices degree of attention that they deserve, we've designed another two-part special for you. This week's guest, Jim Rickards, best-selling author. The book, of course, was Currency Wars back in 2010. Jim has a new book out now called The New Case for Gold, and he'll be giving you the big-picture perspective on exactly where we stand in the currency wars and why Jim believes that the tide has turned and gold has entered a new bull market. So the plan for the Macro Voices Gold Special is Jim this week. Then next week, we're going to be bringing you another guest, Rick Rule, rock star of boots-on-the-ground natural resource investing. Nathan and I will be back after this interview to tell you more about what to expect next week.
And I'm Nathan Egger. I'm happy to be back with you guys. Eric, equities found a consolidation zone around the 2050 area after the relentless march higher in equity prices seemed to stall and level off for the last couple of weeks. But this week, we were able to make that new cycle high. What's your take?
Yeah, it's definitely past time for me, at least. I was stopped out of my position this week. I would say if I had to grade myself, the mistake I made was not putting that trade on in the first place. I think that my logic was very good, way 100 S&P points lower. But you know what? It turned out not to be right. The mistake I made here is I really didn't see how the S&P could break higher if crude didn't. And I really have strong conviction in my crude oil views. I think what we're starting to see now, Nathan, is some decoupling. And if I look in hindsight, I don't mind admitting publicly that my original stop for this trade was right at the 200-day moving average. I gave it more room because I just didn't think it was going to work, and I should have known better. We are seeing a move that, on a fundamental level, I cannot explain. Technically, it looks very bullish in terms of what I see on the chart. I do not understand that because, on a fundamental level, it's not making sense. What that says to me is I can't be in the trade. I've got to be on the sidelines for the S&P because what's going on here doesn't make sense. Definitely, I will be watching for the opportunity for the short entry if we see signs of a reversal. But I've followed this short position way too far already. And as much as it doesn't make sense to me, it looks like the market is pushing higher.
And crude oil, there's a big meeting scheduled this Sunday in Doha, Qatar, where a subset of OPEC members, as well as Russia and a couple of other non-OPEC members, will discuss a so-called production freeze. We've heard a lot about this production freeze for the last couple of months. Anticipation of that meeting seems to have captivated the market. But how do you see this, Eric? Is there anything real or of substance that can come out of this meeting, or are we just going to see more of OPEC playing propaganda hacky sack?
Well, I definitely think it's propaganda hacky sack, but it's very real. And one of the things that you've got to consider, I want to go back to, I think it was September or October of 2014 on another podcast program. I said I had a prediction. And then one of my prediction was, as I said, I smell a rat, and I think it's going to be served on Thanksgiving Day in Vienna, Austria, with stuffing and gravy, because it did not make sense to me that they had such an important OPEC meeting, and they scheduled it on Thanksgiving Day. Now, Thanksgiving Day is obviously a very important holiday in the United States, where most of the oil trading occurs, but the futures markets are open because it is not an international holiday. It is probably the thinnest liquidity day of the year because nobody is trading in New York hours when the New York traders are on vacation. But it is trading. So you saw what I thought was going to be some action by Saudi Arabia intended to spike the market in one direction or the other. That's exactly what they did. They intentionally, I think, had their meeting on Thanksgiving Day so that they would make their press announcement into the thinnest liquidity moment possible and have the biggest impact on the market. You just said, Nathan, this weekend there is a very important meeting. If it's a very important meeting, why is it on a weekend? Why isn't it on a weekday? Why would this meeting have been scheduled so that whatever announcement comes out of it will be made at the most thin liquidity moment of the trading week, which is 6 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday, not Monday, when the futures market opens for that Sunday pre-session? It almost feels as if somebody is setting up to shock the market one way or the other. I think that what's going to happen here, I do think there's a good possibility of more upside. I think there are a lot of people who are wrong, frankly, who think that this meeting is going to solve everything. And I think that that will be proven wrong. So I think it's a huge setup for a buy the rumor, sell the news event. I think there could be more strength on Friday. We're recording this at the end of Thursday's trading session. On Friday, I wouldn't be at all surprised if there's more strength as people want to be long into that meeting. I want to be short into that meeting. You got to be careful being short because I won't be the slightest bit surprised if at the end of the meeting on Sunday afternoon, there is a grand announcement that consensus has been reached and there will be a freeze, which means absolutely nothing. Again, to explain what's going on here, there is a group of five or six countries who could not possibly increase their oil production if they tried. Those people who could not possibly increase their production if they tried are contemplating an agreement to agree not to do something that they cannot possibly do even if they wanted to. This is craziness, but it is profoundly effective. By saying there's a production freeze coming, ooh, there's a freeze, it sounds good. To anybody who doesn't study this carefully, it sounds like a deal of substance, significance, potentially market-changing impact is coming this Sunday. And it's a lie. It's not true. What's happening on Sunday is political theater. A bunch of oil ministers are getting together to talk about nothing of substance in order to try to create a perception that there is some effort to support the oil market here. Now, I think that Saudi Arabia really screwed up. When this thing first came up on January 20th, Saudi was getting everything they wanted, and they were very well set up to create a washout in the junk bond market in the United States. All this Doha for production freeze stuff has given us a 50% rally in oil prices, more than 50% now, on nothing. I think if I was Saudi Arabia, I would walk into that meeting and I'd say, okay, guys, we made an agreement earlier this week, and that agreement was we promised that we would come and make a decision at this meeting independent of Iran. We're going to make our decision without regard to what Iran's going to do. So our decision is no. Period. End of discussion. No further debate. No further anything. We're done. That's the story. If I was Saudi Arabia, that's exactly what I would do, because I don't think Saudi Arabia wants higher oil prices. I think Saudi Arabia wants to wash out the source of credit. We're coming into credit redetermination season for the U.S. shale drillers. This is exactly when Saudi wants to do the most damage, and I think that they are setting up this meeting in order for a big down move in prices. I know I've been saying that for several weeks, folks, but frankly, if you really look objectively here, what Art Berman and I have said about fundamentals has been proven true. Now, the market price has gone the opposite direction of what we expected because of this political theater about the production freeze. Once that is debunked, which I think sometime shortly after the meeting, it should have been debunked, sometime next week, I expect prices to be correcting markedly lower. I've said that several times before. Whether I've been wrong or just early remains to be seen.
And as mentioned, gold is going to be a major theme of this entire show as well as next week's show. But let's still take a moment to get your take on this week's tape action in the gold market.
Yeah, I think we should leave the substantive talk about gold for our guest interviews. One thing I do want to say here, though, because I'm not sure that I've actually said it on the show before, is I am fantastically bullish long-term on gold. There's no doubt in my mind that central banks are going to print more money. This is not over. We have not solved any problem since 2008. There will be more turning to the printing press. Gold will do profoundly well, no doubt in my mind. The question is the cyclical bear market over, and has the new bull market really begun? And that, I think, we'll get into with our guests. One thing I do want to note, because it just happened after we taped today's interview, is that we did finally break down below that 50-day moving average just on today's close. I want to point out, though, we broke below the 50-day moving average by just a smidgen, such a small amount that if you were to look at the 50-day moving average drawn on the futures chart and the 50-day moving average drawn on, say, stockcharts.com on the spot price, just the little difference that there is might make the difference between whether we're above or below it. So I'm not going to call this a breakdown below the 50-day moving average. I'm going to call it the beginning of a breakdown. Looks like we could see that move lower that I've been talking about. I do think whether or not the 50-day holds is going to be the test here. It's sort of kind of starting to look on Thursday afternoon like maybe it's not going to hold, but we haven't seen enough weakness to really persuade me that that line is going to break yet.
Excellent. Thank you for your insights as always, Eric. We're going to kick off our two-part gold special with Eric's interview with best-selling author Jim Rickards. Due to Mr. Rickards' schedule limitations, we taped this interview back on March 31st. That interview is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
We've had numerous listener requests to do a gold show, but a pet peeve of mine is that many of the self-professed gold experts just want to talk gold, gold, gold all day long, but they're not prepared to discuss precious metals in the context of the prevailing macroeconomic backdrop. I mean, stop and think about it. How can one possibly have an opinion on the price of gold without first having an opinion on whether or not the stalled U.S. dollar rally is set to continue or falter? How can you possibly have a view on gold without first understanding the role that gold plays in the global central bank reserve asset system? And what about the topic of currency wars? How does gold fit into that story? My complaint with the gold bugs is that they're so excited about gold that they can't articulate how gold fits into the big picture. Joining me now is best-selling author Jim Rickards, who is the absolute antithesis of the narrow-minded gold bugs that I described a moment ago. Jim is not only aware of the currency wars, but he literally wrote the book on that subject back in 2010. He has a new book out called The New Case for Gold. Jim, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Eric. Great to be with you.
Jim, our audience is pro-finance, high-net-worth, and other sophisticated investors. So these guys already know the basics. And they know that despite the excellent long-term fundamental argument for gold, the fact remains that gold and silver have been in a cyclical bear market for almost 5 years now. So our audience is very keen to know whether that cyclical bear market is over, but they want the full story in the context of currency wars, central bank policy, the perspective of a macroeconomic framework that may be bringing negative interest rates and so forth. In this environment, why in the world would a zero yielding asset make sense? So I've got a checklist of a few topics here, Jim, but I know this is a topic that you're extremely experienced with. Where do you want to start?
Well, I guess I'd make a couple of points, Eric. The bull market, bear market analysis, it's a little bit a matter of picking your spots. Gold is the first problem is that when people say gold is up or down or it's in a bull market or bear market, what they're really doing is they're privileging the U.S. dollar. In other words, what they're saying is the dollar price of gold is up, where the dollar price of gold is down. And then they use that to back into analyses such as bull market, bear market. But what they don't realize that they're actually doing is saying that the dollar is the measure of all things. But what you can do is you can make gold the measure, make gold what the French mathematical term called the numeraire. And the numeraire matters in terms of how you think about whether things are up or down. For example, if I send out two people and I ask them to measure a football field, and I give one of them a ruler and I give the other one a yardstick, and they come back and the guy with the ruler says it's 300 feet long and the guy with the yardstick says it's 100 yards long. Well, of course, they're both correct, but they came up with different numeric values because they had different measuring sticks or numeraires. So when you say gold is up or gold is down, that's not how I think about it. I think of an ounce of gold as my yardstick, if you will, as my numeraire. And then when gold is $1,000 an ounce, I say, well, it takes a dollar gets you 1/1,000th of an ounce of gold. And if gold is $1,500 an ounce, I say that a dollar gets you 1/1,500th of an ounce of gold. And what really happened is that gold didn't go up, the dollar went down. So the easiest way to understand gold, you know, if you think of it as an investment, which I don't, I don't think gold is an investment. I think of it as money. But if you want to think of it as an investment, you know, when the dollar price of gold is up, you're just getting less gold for your dollar. When the dollar price of gold is down, you're getting more gold for your dollar. In other words, what really happened is the dollar went down or the dollar went up. So I think that's sort of mentally going through the looking glass, and you start to look at the world in a completely different way. Now, it is true that if you measure it in dollars, gold was down about 45% from August 2011 to November 2015. That's depending on how you start or where you start, that could be a 50% retracement, which is not uncommon in commodities trading, for example. But gold is the best performing asset class in 2016. It's also the best performing asset class of the 21st century, compared to stocks, bonds, and other commodities. So I know that's a little bit of a game, pick your starting point, and anybody can pick a starting point that suits them. A stock bull can say, hey, I'm going to measure from March 2009 as if everyone's a genius and went out and bought stocks in March 2009. And that's fine. But I just point out that there are two flaws, or I guess two differences I would have in the reasoning of calling it a bear market, because if you look at the dollar index, I use the Fed's broad trade-weighted dollar index. I don't use DXY because that's really just a substitute for euro-dollar cross rate. But if you use the Fed's broad trade-weighted real dollar index, the all-time low for the dollar was August 2011, which was also the all-time high for gold, denominated in dollars, which is another way of saying that the dollar price of gold is just a cross rate. It's like, you know, you can look at dollar euro, look at dollar yen, yen euro. These are all cross rates. And if you think of gold as money, it's just another cross rate. So I don't think of gold as an investment because it has no yield. That's another critique of gold. People go, oh, why would you have gold? It has no yield. Well, it's not supposed to have a yield. It's money. You know, take it, reach into your pocket and take a dollar bill out of your pocket, hold it up and look at it. What's the yield? Zero. You know, take a 500 euro note, hold it in front of you. What's the yield? It's zero. In other words, if you have a Bitcoin, I don't recommend Bitcoins, but I consider them a form of money. If you have a Bitcoin, what's the yield? It's zero. In other words, all forms of money have zero yield. If you want yield, you have to take risk. You have to take your money and convert it into something else. Now, people take money and they put it in the bank, and the bank pays them practically nothing, but pays you a little something. You get a little bit of yield there, or you can put it in money market fund and get a little more yield. And people say, see, my money has yield. And I say, no, it doesn't, because that's not money. If you put money in a bank, that's a deposit, which is an unsecured liability of a financial institution, which have occasionally been insolvent. As recently as 2008, all the major banks were insolvent. And you say, well, I've got deposit insurance. Well, okay, but maybe the deposit insurance fund goes bankrupt. Maybe the bank is shut. Maybe the power grid's down. Maybe your amount is more than the deposit insurance amount. Or maybe you live in Greece, or maybe you live in Cyprus. In other words, the point is bank deposits are not risk-free. They may be low risk. I'm not saying pull all your money out of the bank and go buy gold. But what I am saying is that to get yield, you have to take risk. And money has no yield because it has no risk. So gold, dollars, euros, yen, Bitcoin, they're all forms of money, and they have zero yield. But just for the record, obviously the world is moving to negative interest rates, and in a world of negative interest rates, the zero yield is the high yield asset.
Now, let's pick up on this dollar theme. For those investors who do keep score in dollars, they care about the value in dollars. So the U.S. dollar has been appreciating against other currencies since the beginning of 2014, end of 2013. Some people think that's over because that rally appears to have stalled, and they think it's going to reverse. We had Axel Merck a couple weeks ago on the program. Other people think that the dollar rally, Goldman Sachs recently said the dollar rally was set to continue. So where do you stand on the dollar rally? Because as you described, that obviously has a very direct impact on the price of gold.
Sure. Well, the dollar rally depends what side of the bed Janet Yellen gets out of in the morning. You know, in December, she laid out a path of increasing the Fed funds target rate, policy rate, 300 basis points over 3 years, which would have worked out to about 100 basis points a year. She set a slow tempo. Typically, that means 25 basis points. There are 8 FOMC meetings a year, so that would be 4 rate hikes a year for the next 3 years. Every other meeting was like clockwork. Now, of course, it wasn't like clockwork, and everybody knew it was data-dependent and there could be exceptions, but she basically laid out a path of 25 basis point rate hikes every other meeting for the next 3 years. You get to March, which was the first crunch point. That's when they should have raised rates according to her schedule. And they didn't do it. So they tore that up right out of the gate. And then her speech at the New York Economic Club yesterday was, or 2 days ago, was, I don't know, shocking or I'm not sure what the right word is, but she's like a pod person. I mean, she had been taken over, her brain had been taken over by Charlie Evans of the Chicago Fed and Lael Brainard, who's one of the board of governors, and she went completely with what Evans had been saying through all of 2015. Charlie Evans said, he was, you know, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, wrote a very good academic paper in March 2015, and he said, look, the risks of changing policy in a period of high uncertainty are asymmetric. And it was what he said was, if we wait and don't raise rates, he was voting not to raise rates. He said, if we don't raise rates, if inflation runs away from us a little bit, no problem. We can just raise rates faster and squash it. We know how to do that. But if we raise rates prematurely and we exacerbate deflation, we don't know how to get out of deflation. So he says, we know how to cure inflation. We don't necessarily know how to cure deflation. So because those risks are asymmetric, that argues in favor of doing nothing until we really see the inflation, you know, see the whites of its eyes. Yellen pushed back on that. Yellen said, no, a monetary policy acts with a lag. Inflation's a genie. We don't want to get out of the bottle. We want to stay ahead of it. She was using Phillips curve, NAIRU, a number of other metrics, looking at unemployment, looking at job creation, saying, you know, inflation's right around the corner. That was the debate through all of 2015. Yellen basically won in December with the rate hike, and then Charlie Evans must have given her a brain transplant because in her speech to the Economic Club, she just practically quoted Evans. There's a section of the speech, it's just, you know, it's her words, but right out of Evans' playbook, she uses the word asymmetric. She says, you know, inflation is easier to stop than deflation. That argues. So anyway, the market, I mean, correctly interpreted this as super dovish. But then you say, okay, where does that leave us? Because we were kind of set up for this string of rate hikes. Now, they probably do want to hike rates for other reasons, which has to do with something Larry Summers pointed out, which was that historically, and Summers did a nice piece of research on this, he said, when the U.S. goes into a recession, it takes 300 basis points of cuts to get out of the recession. That's how much easing the Fed has to do to kind of reverse the impact of a recession. Well, how do you cut 300 basis points when you're at 25? The answer is you can't, obviously. And so part of Yellen saying, I want to get to 300 basis points, was that so she could have 300 basis points to cut in the next recession. And by the way, this recovery, it's been anemic. It's been one of the weakest recoveries in U.S. history, but it's a recovery nonetheless. And it's about, if I'm not mistaken, 84 months old. The average post-1980 recession is 78 months old. So this is longer than the average post-1980 recession, expansion. This is longer than the average post-1980 expansion by a number of months, and the post-1980 period has had two of the longest peacetime expansions in U.S. history. So, you know, recessions don't die of old age. It doesn't mean that the recession starts tomorrow, but nobody should be surprised if it does. So here's Yellen sort of caught between a rock and a hard place. She wants to raise rates so she can cut them in the recession. A recession could be right around the corner. It could be staring her in the face. A lot of data is coming in a week. It's mixed. You know, some's positive, but there's a lot of negative data. On the other hand, she's got Charlie Evans on one shoulder and Leo Brandon on the other saying, don't you dare raise rates because the economy's weak. This is where the currency wars come in. You know, if China is pegged to the dollar and we make the dollar stronger, the Chinese currency gets stronger vis-a-vis their trading partners in Europe and Japan at a time when they want to cut rates because their economy is falling off a cliff. So there's just no good way out of this. She can't escape the room. So for now, obviously no rate hike in April. And they'll talk about June, but markets have already priced in no rate hikes probably until late 2016, early 2017. So if she wants to hike rates in June, they're going to have to change expectations. That means, leaks and speeches and all that, but that could knock the market out of bed. Meanwhile, gold is sitting there like a form of money. Yeah, an easier dollar, a weaker dollar is good for gold. So gold's had a good lift. Gold, as I say, is the best performing asset class in 2016, partly based on these dovish noises that are coming out of the Fed. But they, they're very inconsistent. They could turn on a dime. So what I expect most of all is volatility. I think we're going to see stocks kind of go, it's what I call non-directional volatility. I think stocks will go sideways, up and down quite a bit, but not really go anywhere based on the latest, leaks from the Fed, and gold will probably do likewise until some of this gets resolved. But my advice for investors, Eric, is to just have 10% of your investable assets in gold. And I talk about this in my book, The New Case for Gold. When I say investable assets, take your home equity and take your business equity and put it to one side. So if you're, a car dealer, dentist, doctor, lawyer, pizza parlor operator, dry cleaner operator, whatever it may be, put that equity to one side, put your home equity to one side, whatever's left over, those are your investable assets. And I recommend 10% of that in gold. If everything falls apart, you'll be very well served. The gold will hold up very well. It'll preserve value in every state of the world. If everything's wonderful, maybe the gold kind of goes sideways, but you'll be making so much money on everything else, you'll be a happy camper. So it's kind of a portfolio insurance approach. I analogize it to buying fire insurance on your house. Nobody wants his house to burn down. But if it does burn down, you're very happy you have the insurance. And when you write the check to the insurance company, you don't think you're wasting money. You think that's money well spent because it's preserving your wealth and your dwelling. So gold can perform that role in a portfolio. It's the one thing that'll still be standing when everything else falls apart.
Now, I want to check in with you on that idea that it'll still be standing, though, because a lot of people are concerned about prohibition, confiscation, taxation considerations. And I think this is particularly timely right now because I think that negative interest rates are definitely something that a lot of central banks around the world are contemplating. You can't really have negative interest rates and still have cash, because people would just take the cash out and put it in a safe deposit box. To some extent, gold really provides another workaround to what the system is trying to accomplish with negative interest rates. Are you concerned, Jim, that regulators will prohibit retail investors from owning gold because it undermines the government's agenda with negative interest rates?
Well, let's say I were. Isn't that a good reason to buy it right now?
if you don't think it's going to be taken away from you, I guess that would be true.
Well, that's unconstitutional. But look, I know what happened in 1933. President Roosevelt issued an executive order. Now, President Roosevelt got around the Fifth Amendment by he ordered the gold to be handed in, but he paid everybody $20 an ounce. What he didn't tell us is it was the ultimate insider trading case, because what he didn't tell Americans was that his plan was to raise it to $35 an ounce, which he did. So what he wanted to do, he wanted to scoop up all the gold at $20, then raise it to $35, and the Treasury would get all the profit. And that's exactly what happened. In fact, that delta between the $20 price and the $35 price, which went to the Treasury, that was used to fund something called the ESF, the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which to this day is an unaccountable Treasury slush fund. It does not require congressional authorization to use or spend. It's completely in the discretion of the Secretary of the Treasury and, by extension, ultimately the White House. It was actually used by Bob Rubin to bail out Mexico in 1994 when the Congress refused to do so. There was a Mexican bailout proposal on the table. Congress was asked for a vote to bail out Mexico. They refused, and Bob Rubin said, well, the heck with Congress, I'll just use the Exchange Stabilization Fund. And he did, so he kind of walked all over Congress in that one. But that fund came from the profit that the Treasury made by hoovering up gold at $20 and repricing it. Now, could they do that again? It's very unlikely, in my view, for a couple of reasons. The statutory authority that the president used, President Roosevelt used in 1933, believe it or not, was the Trading with the Enemy Act of 1917. Now, the Trading with the Enemy Act of 1917 was enacted during the Woodrow Wilson administration so we could seize German assets at a time when we were at war with Germany. This is how we got Bayer Aspirin, which was part of Bayer AG, a big German pharmaceutical and chemical company. So we seized a bunch of German assets. So Roosevelt used that to seize the gold in 1933. I don't know who the enemy was. It was Trading with the Enemy Act. I guess the enemy was the American people. But that was a stretch. And then he got some post hoc ratification from Congress. But I think then there was a lot more trust in government. There was a lot more belief that government knew what they were doing. There was certainly a sense that people had to pull together in the Great Depression. And I think Roosevelt traded on all that goodwill. Today, that goodwill doesn't exist. People distrust government. I think you look at the rise of Bernie Sanders and the rise of Donald Trump is pretty good testimony to the fact that, people are consider the government an adversary. So I'm not sure they would be such willing, sheep led to the slaughter. I don't think you could get the congressional approval. There would be legal impediments, et cetera, absent something much closer to social chaos and martial law. I don't see that happening. I think there'd be a lot of pushback if there was. But the fact is, so I don't necessarily see that coming, but, and I hear it a lot. You know, it's funny, people who hear the argument for gold understand the logic of it, then they start looking for reasons not to do it. And they say, well, what's the point of buying gold? They're just going to take it away. Well, they're probably not going to take it away, but that's a pretty weak reason not to buy it. I mean, they could take your stocks away. You're not going to buy stocks because of that. So, you know, years ago, I ran into people when gold was $700, and I would make a lot of the same points I'm making now, or I make in my book, The New Case for Gold. And people say, yeah, good idea, Jim. I'm going to get some gold. And then you see me a year later and say, hey, did you ever get the gold? Nah, I never did it. You know, so Americans have been conditioned, miseducated, brainwashed, pick your word, for 40 years, going on three generations at this point, to believe that gold has no monetary role, no investment role. And so Americans really don't understand gold. It's interesting. I travel on five continents. I speak to people all over the world. And when you go abroad, they have a much, much better understanding of it. But I do my best, and I consider my book, The New Case for Gold, to be educational. I'm not a gold salesman. I don't get, commissions when people buy gold, but I am an author, an analyst, and a researcher, and advisor, and a consultant, a couple other things. And I wrote it really for educational purposes because I was kind of fed up with all the stereotypical arguments which against gold, which actually do not hold water.
Let's come back to Fed policy. You talked about at some point more accommodation, a QE4 from the Fed would obviously, they're printing more money, they're weakening the value of the dollar, that's good for gold. But on the other hand, Fed, at least the advertised policy, let's call it the advertised monetary policy, is supposedly we can expect a long string of Fed rate hikes as we go through a normalization process back to traditionally normal interest rates. I personally don't believe that that's really going to happen, but a lot of people do. So where does that leave us in this whole gold story? We have kind of an ambiguous policy direction from the Fed, because on the one hand, their message is very clear. It's about rate normalization and hiking. It's just that nobody believes that.
Well, let's go back to early December, before the December 15th rate hike. Now, let's go all the way back to November 2014. I said in November 2014 categorically that I didn't see how the Fed would be able to raise interest rates in 2015. And this was when Wall Street was telling you March. Then March came and went, and Wall Street told you June. And then June came and went, and Wall Street said September. And September came and went. The whole time I was sticking to my forecast that the Fed would not and could not raise rates. So I got, I was right for 11 out of 12 months or 7 out of 8 meetings. And finally by December, it was clear that they were going to raise rates. And I said so at the time. I said, okay, they're finally going to raise rates. But it's a blunder. I said that the economy is weak. We're bordering on recession. China is collapsing. Japan's in a recession. Russia, Brazil, Europe are all in recessions. The global growth is hanging by a thread. Christine Lagarde said the same thing. And I said, okay, the Fed will raise rates in December, finally, after going 11 months without doing it. But it'll be a blunder. The market's going to fall out of bed. They're tightening into weakness. The Fed is supposed to ease into weakness and tighten into strength when things get when inflation gets hot or labor markets get tight. And here they are tightening into weakness, which makes absolutely no sense. So anyway, they tightened and they laid out this 300 basis point rate hike path, and right on cue, markets fell out of bed. And we had a technical correction over the course of January, early February. So then the Fed, and my expectation at the time was that they would persist in this course based on their models, which are obsolete, but they believe them, so based on their models, until the evidence of weakness and probably technical recession became undeniable, at which point they would start to ease again. So my big forecast in December for 2016 was the Fed would ease before the end of the year. Where I missed it was that they threw in the towel 6 months earlier than I thought. I thought that it would take until August before they got the wake-up call. They actually got the wake-up call in, you know, right out of the gate in January, February. So they've already thrown in the towel. So I think I won my bet, because what the Fed did at the March meeting is a form of ease by talking. You know, we'll see what they do in April, but the Economic Club speech is really a form of forward guidance. The Fed has a lot of easing tools. Now, obviously, they can cut rates. Now they can cut them 25 basis points because they raised them 25 basis points. I don't expect that right away, but that's one tool. But the other tools, of course, are some of them you mentioned, Eric. There's QE. There are negative interest rates once you get back to zero. There's forward guidance, currency wars, Operation Twist, financial repression. They actually have a lot of tools in the toolkit. So it will be interesting to see what they do next. If they don't raise, it looks like there's no chance in April. I guess June is still on the table, although the markets are not giving that a high probability. But the way to ease is kind of what Janet Yellen did 2 days ago, which is forward guidance. Just say, hey, coast is clear. Put on the carry trade, risk on, you know, go borrow dollars, invest in, you're going to have a weak dollar. We're not going to raise rates. Go buy some South African stocks or whatever it is. You know, just sort of start the party again. The problem with that is that you're creating asset bubbles. I mean, they want inflation, meaning consumer price inflation, you know, a PCE core deflator, but they're not getting it. But we are getting bubbles. Same mistake Greenspan made between 2002 and 2005. So, you know, what's it going to be? You know, tighten into recession, raise rates to have a little dry powder if you get to a recession, but do you cause the recession in the process of doing so? Do you continue weakness and get asset bubbles? Then when the asset bubbles burst, you'll have a financial panic, which is worse than a recession. Again, going back to what I said earlier, I just don't see any good ways out for them. But so gold, I wrote a column recently. I said gold is a chameleon, meaning at times it trades like a commodity. It trades, you know, kind of pretty highly correlated to the continuous commodity index. I don't think gold is a commodity. The reason I think it's not a commodity is because it's not good for anything. In other words, gold is the best form of money, but it's not really good for anything else. I mean, it's not a major industrial input. The industrial uses of gold are quite few. People say, what about jewelry? Well, jewelry is just wearable wealth. I mean, you can have rings and necklaces and bracelets all day long, but to me, that's just a form of wealth preservation, wealth storage. It's gold bullion in, you know, cosmetically appealing form. So just talk to any Indian bride adorned with necklaces. She'll say, this is my savings account. This is my legacy. This is my inheritance to my children, my gift to my children. They can wear it, but it's really just wearable wealth. So I don't distinguish between jewelry and bullion. As I said, there are a few industrial uses. So gold's not, the definition of a commodity is it's sort of a more or less generic input to something else. So you use oil for energy, you use copper for pipes, you use, you know, wood, lumber for construction. They're all inputs, but they're kind of not particularly high value added. They might have extraction costs, but they're simple inputs to other more high value added processes. That's what a commodity is. Gold doesn't fit that definition. I know it trades on the COMEX, but it's not really a commodity, although sometimes it trades that way. The second definition of gold, people think of it as an investment. I think it belongs in investors' portfolios to preserve wealth in a particular form of money and as a hedge against dollar inflation and, in fact, dollar deflation. We can talk about why gold is a good deflation hedge, but it's not really an investment because it has no yield. We talked about that earlier. Investments are supposed to have some risk and some yield. Gold has no risk and it has no yield because it's money. Then the third element is it is money, and we already talked about that. So the point I was making, I said gold can sometimes be a commodity, sometimes be an investment, sometimes be money. I personally think of it as money, but the market thinks of it as one of the three. So it's like a chameleon. It changes its character. Interestingly, this began in November 2000.
Let me just interrupt you for a second, sure. Jim. Please go ahead and elaborate on the deflation hedge aspect of gold, because I think a lot of investors aren't aware of that.
Well, the longest sustained period of deflation in U.S. history was 1929 to 1933. In that period, gold went up 75%. So the best performing stock on the New York Stock Exchange during the Great Depression was Homestake Mining, which was a gold mine. And why was that? It was because the government forced the price of gold up. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, President Roosevelt, by fiat, by order, basically told the Treasury to bid up the price of gold. There's a very famous story where it was by Alan Meltzer who put it in his history of the Federal Reserve, where President Roosevelt was in bed in his pajamas and summoned the Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Morgenthau, and said, Henry, what do we want the price of gold to be today? I know, bid it up 7 cents an ounce because 7 cents is my lucky number. And, you know, sure enough, Morgenthau called the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and they bid up the price of gold 7 cents that day. They did it in small increments, but over about an 8 month period, they took it from $20 an ounce to $35 an ounce. Now, why did they do that? They certainly did not want to reward gold holders. They, in fact, they had already confiscated all the gold. They did it because they wanted to get the price of everything else up. And if nothing happens in a vacuum, and gold was viewed as a form of money. So by bidding up the price of gold, what they were really doing was devaluing the dollar. It was an earlier version of the currency wars. They were devaluing the dollar, but what they wanted to happen, it was exactly what did happen, which is all of a sudden, you know, coal, wheat, corn, steel. 1933 was one of the best years ever for the stock market, beginning in March 1933 and into 1934, there was a great rally. So they bid up the price of gold to get the price of everything else to go up. You know, if gold goes to, right now it's around 12, 20 an ounce, give or take. If gold goes to $5,000 an ounce, that's not happening in isolation. That $5,000 gold, you know, that's the world of, you know, $300 oil, $100 silver, you know, et cetera. Cotton, all these other commodities are going to go a lot higher because, as I say, gold is not a commodity, really. It's a form of money. And so the point being, governments cannot tolerate deflation. They cannot tolerate deflation for several reasons. Number one, it increases the real value of the debt. The U.S. debt is, you know, people say it's unpayable. It doesn't have to be paid. It does have to be rolled over. Alexander Hamilton figured that out, you know, 230 years ago. It has to be rolled over. It has to be sustainable. Right now, the U.S. is on a non-sustainable path. We're not at the point of a complete bond market breakdown, but we're getting closer to that point. Well, when you have deflation, the real value of the debt goes up and makes the debt even more non-sustainable. It gets closer to that panic point. So you've got to have inflation to make the value of the debt go away, number one. Number two, governments can't tax it. In other words, let's say you make $100,000 and you get a 10% raise. Let's assume prices are constant. Well, you had a 10% increase in your standard of living because you got a 10% raise with constant prices. But the government comes along and takes half. So, you know, your real standard of living only went up 5%, not 10%. Now imagine another world where you have $100,000, you don't get a raise, but prices drop 10%. Well, you have the same 10% increase in your standard of living. With the same nominal salary, your standard of living went up 10% because prices dropped that much. That's deflation. But the government can't tax it. The government hasn't figured out how to tax your improvement in your standard of living coming from deflation. So governments hate deflation because they can't tax it. The third reason is that it leads to debt defaults, and that goes back on the banking system, and the Fed's job one is to preserve the bank. So for all the reasons I mentioned, makes debt non-sustainable, hurts the banking system, and government cannot tax the benefit to the people. Governments hate deflation, have to do everything possible to stop it. So that's what's been going on the last last seven years with, you know, QE1, QE2, QE3, Operation Twist, currency wars, forward guidance, you know, et cetera. It's all designed to get some inflation. Currency wars are about importing inflation in the form of higher import prices once your currency cheapens. None of it's working. None of it's working. And if deflation gets out of control, there's one thing that always works, which is to raise the dollar price of gold, because gold can't fight back. If you think of gold as an entrant in the currency wars, you know, if I cheapen against the euro, then Mario Draghi can come back and cheapen the euro, then I cheapen the dollar again, he cheapens the euro again. Same thing with the yen, Chinese yuan. This is what the currency wars are all about. But the problem is nobody can win a currency war because all advantage is temporary and you're kind of on a seesaw. Currencies cannot all depreciate against each other at the same time. It's a mathematical impossibility. That's why it's very easy to analyze currencies, because you go back to 2012, let's say, I mean, what was going on? You had Rubini and Krugman and Stiglitz and all these guys running around with their hair on fire saying, the euro's collapsing and Greece is going to quit and get kicked out and Spain should quit and go back to the peseta and devalue the peseta and lower the unit labor costs and there should be a northern tier and a southern tier. And I said at the time that that was nonsense, that nobody was quitting the euro, nobody was getting kicked out of the euro. The euro would hang together and actually expand, which has happened. When I said that, there were 16 members. Today, there are 19 members and several applications pending. So the euro is fine. But the point I was making is that was everyone kept saying the euro was going to go down. I said, well, how does the euro go down without the dollar going up? They never, in talking trash about the euro, they never looked over at the United States and said, well, that means a stronger dollar. And this was at a time when the dollar was quite low and going back to 2011. So, and if you do have a stronger dollar, that's going to hurt the U.S. economy, which ultimately it has. So you have to look at all these cross rates. But there is one way, there is one and only one way for every currency in the world to depreciate at the same time, and that is against gold. Because gold is a form of money that's not printed, not issued by a central bank, and gold can't fight back. That is what happened in the 1930s. Now, we're not at that stage yet, but my point to asset allocators is, you know, gold's going to do very well in inflation. You can count on that. But in extreme deflation, gold also does well because governments force the price up because they're desperate to get out of deflation.
Now, I want to go back to monetary policy for a minute, particularly with respect to quantitative easing. I'm hearing more and more voices come out saying different versions of the same story, which basically is one or another form of helicopter money. They think that more quantitative easing is coming, but they don't think it's going to look like the last three rounds. They think it's maybe going to be more focused on printing money, not for the benefit of Wall Street, but for the benefit of Main Street, potentially in connection with some political campaign. If that were to happen, one variation of that I've even seen, Dr. Pippa Malgram has a book coming out talking about her prediction that the next round of QE will all go into military spending. The point, though, is not to prop up asset prices. First question, do you agree with the people who see that coming? The next round of QE might not be supporting asset prices. It might be doing something else. And if so, what does that mean for the outlook on gold?
I agree completely. I mean, there's very little doubt that that's what's happening. I know Pippa. She's a great analyst. She's right. Larry Summers has been calling for it. You know, everyone's calling for it. Ray Dalio, Christine Lagarde. The real, if you want to see the real blueprint, the power elite blueprint for what we just discussed, there's a book called Between Debt and the Devil by Adair Turner. Adair Turner is the head of a George Soros think tank called the Institute for New Economic Thinking. But it's basically the power elite blueprint for what we just discussed. Now, the difference between this and QE is that you have to combine monetary policy and fiscal policy. So the way QE works is governments buy bonds from the banks, but they pay for the bonds with money that comes out of thin air. So, you know, I'm the Federal Reserve, you're Citibank. I say, you know, sell me some 10-year notes and you sell them to me and I pay you for them. And the money I used to pay you comes out of thin air. But the problem is the banks then take the money and give it back to the Federal Reserve in the form of excess reserves. So the money doesn't go anywhere. There's no velocity. There's no lending. There's no spending. It's not stimulating aggregate demand. It's just, you know, you're kind of affecting the shape of the yield curve and the level of rates, but you're not really doing anything to get the money into circulation, help the real economy. Now, helicopter money, so-called, also involves printing money, but it comes in a different form. First, the fiscal authority, and that would be the Congress or a parliament or some legislative body, has to vote to approve more spending. And, you know, take your pick. If it's the Democrats, it's probably, you know, more on healthcare and Medicare, Medicaid, education, the environment, social welfare, et cetera. If it's the Republicans, it's probably more military spending. If you get Paul Ryan and, you know, Nancy Pelosi together, you'll probably have both. You know, you'll have a spending party. But the point is, there's more spending. The deficits are larger. Now, that money actually does get spent, unlike the money that the Fed prints under QE, which doesn't go anywhere. This money somebody gets it. I mean, it could be Boeing or Lockheed or Northrop Grumman, or it could be some community organizer, Acorn, whatever. But somebody's getting the money. And, you know, under kind of Keynes, you know, 101, you know, they then go take their wife out to dinner, husband out to dinner, whatever. And then somehow this money gets into circulation. I'm very doubtful that that's the result, by the way, but that's the theory. So now you've increased the deficit. And the Treasury has to issue more bonds to cover the deficit, and the Fed buys the bonds by printing money. So you still have, so it's really debt monetization. So you still have money printing at the end of the day, but it's being used to spend rather than end up in the Fed in the form of excess reserves. And, you know, Derek Turner also argues for debt cancellation. And, you know, then it does make a difference how you spend the money. Some ways are more wasteful than others. You know, in 2009, we had a big stimulus bill that did nothing for the economy. And I don't think Larry Summers will ever live it down. But that's another example of, you know, wasted spending. And there are a lot of skeptics on this. But that's the basic idea. This is definitely coming because there's no other way out. See, the problem is that we're in a depression. The world has been in a depression since 2007. Depressions are structural in nature. That's the difference between a depression and a business cycle or a technical recession. They're structural in nature. You cannot fix a structural problem with monetary solutions. They don't work. You need structural solutions. Structural solutions involve the fiscal authority. So it could be bigger deficits, more deficit spending. It could be, you know, labor market, you know, labor mobility, labor market reform, environmental reform, regulatory reform. It could take many forms. But unless you step up and make those structural reforms, you're not going to get out of the depression we're in. Now, that's the theory. That is in the air. You're absolutely right, Eric. And it's being talked about by a lot of the, you know, the power elites, you know, finance ministers and professors and, you know, large hedge fund managers, et cetera. The problem is getting it done. You can't just wave a magic wand. You've actually got to get the Congress to vote for this. I don't see the U.S. Congress doing it. Maybe the British Parliament. But Britain's not that big a player. Also, Japan has been doing this on and off, because they wasted a lot of the money. China's very good at it, but they wasted even more money. I mean, I've been to China, you know, walked around construction sites, got mud on my boots in these ghost cities. I've seen the ghost cities, as, you know, to the horizon. Not just one ghost city. I saw 7 ghost cities in a row, you know, one after the other, each one with a couple high rises, apartment buildings, golf course, luxury hotel, conference center, high-end shopping, you know, metro stop, highway exit, et cetera, everything, all empty as far as the eye can see. So, you know, you can roll steel and make glass and cut copper and do construction and build this stuff. And that's how they've been powering their GDP for the last 10 years, at least a significant part of it. But it's all wasted. If you adjusted China's GDP for the amount of waste, their actual growth would have been more like maybe 4% instead of when it was 9 or 10. And today it's probably down as low as 3. I mean, it's dangerously low for such a large economy. So the problem, you're absolutely right about the theory of helicopter money, but it won't actually work, in my view, for 3 reasons. Number one, there's a reluctance of the fiscal authorities to actually do the deficit spending. Number two, I'm doubtful about velocity because of socio-psychological reasons. Maybe people do get the money, but that doesn't mean they go spend it. They might just put it in the bank or pay it on debt. I mean, a good example of that was when the price of oil plunged beginning in June 2014. Remember how many economists in late 2014 going into 2015, they were saying, well, you know, price of gasoline has come from $4 a gallon to $2 a gallon, and people use, 50 gallons a week. And so that's $100 savings. It's $5,000 a year pre-tax. You know, they're going to go out and spend all this money. Happy days are here again. And I said, no, I said, the $5,000 is real. You know, when gas goes down $2 a gallon, you get, you know, $5,000 a year in your pocket if you're using 50 gallons a week. So that's real. But it doesn't mean people are going to spend it. They either save the money or they pay down debt, whether it's home equity loans, credit cards, student loans, you know, whatever it might be. And again, there's no velocity. And that's a psychological problem. So I'm doubtful that helicopter money will be enacted. If it is, I'm doubtful it will work because people might just pay down debt. And then I'm even more doubtful that the project selected will be productive at the end of the day. So it just looks like another slow motion train wreck. Meanwhile, the world is not getting out of this depression that I described.
I'd like to close on a final topic that almost nobody is talking about. Russian scholar Sergei Glazyev has masterminded what he calls a de-dollarization plan. And basically, Mr. Glazyev's agenda is that he feels that the U.S. enjoys too much privilege. What French Finance Minister Valéry Giscard d'Estaing called exorbitant privilege, the ability to borrow money in the world's reserve currency. Mr. Glazyev is trying to persuade the world, starting with the BRICS countries, to abandon the dollar as a reserve currency. And the West, as far as I can tell, is ignoring this completely. I feel sometimes like I'm the only guy that takes this seriously. And yes, it's true that Russia is not the most powerful nation in the world, But the BRICS countries represent like half the human beings on the planet. And my take on this, Jim, is the reason that the U.S. dollar is the world's reserve currency is because there is no viable alternative. Well, if we've got this guy Glazyev motivated to come up with an alternative, and like half of the people in the world are starting to pile in, isn't this a big issue that we should be paying attention to?
Yes, and actually, this was the scenario I played out in 2009. I talked about this in my first book, Currency Wars. But I was asked by the Office of the Secretary of Defense to facilitate and help structure, and then actually later participated in the first ever financial war game. So, of course, the Pentagon's been doing war games for decades. They didn't need any help from me in that in general. But it was the first ever financial war game, so they reached out for some capital markets and financial expertise. We did this at a top secret weapons laboratory about halfway between Washington and Baltimore. We had uniformed military, CIA, Treasury, Fed, think tank people. I said to the organizers, you know, wars involve a lot of deceit and deception and manipulation, so you ought to allow me to invite some of my Wall Street friends in so we can make it more realistic. And they agreed with that, so I got a couple folks from UBS and a Russian private equity fund. Anyway, we played this out over a couple of days, but the scenario that I launched in conjunction with some others was one where Russia and China pooled their gold reserves and put them in a vault in Switzerland, and then created a new London bank of issue that would issue a new currency backed by the gold in the vault in Switzerland. And the kicker was that henceforth, if you wanted Russian natural resource exports or Chinese manufactured goods, you had to pay for it in this new currency. Dollars were no longer acceptable. And if you wanted some of the new currency, you could either trade with them and run a surplus, and then you'd have some, or you could borrow some from this London bank, or you could deposit your own gold and then get some yourself based on the gold that you put into the vault. Now, we never thought this would happen the next day, and obviously it was a stretch of a scenario, but that's what you're supposed to do in war games. You're supposed to look over not just one ridgeline, but probably two ridgelines, and help the Pentagon think, you know, years or even decades ahead in terms of threats to national security. We actually got laughed at by a couple of people in the room, some Harvard professors. One guy just laughed in my face and said, why are you wasting our time with this? Don't you know that gold's not part of the international monetary system? It never will be again. This just seems like a complete waste of time to talk about this scenario. I said, well, let's just, you know, it's a war game. Let's just play it out and see how it plays out. And it played out in very interesting ways. And again, I talk about those in my book, Currency Wars. Notwithstanding the ridicule, in fact, since 2009, Russia has increased its reserves, gold reserves, by more than 100%. They've added over 1,000 tons. China has increased its gold reserves 300 or 400%. They've added about 4,000 tons. No one knows the exact number because they keep it a secret. They say they have 1,700 tons, but that's clearly not true. They have something close to 4,000 tons. We know that from, you know, we have reliable Hong Kong import data and geological surveys, mining output. So we can do a pretty good estimate of how much gold China actually has. And I've also met with, you know, secure logistics operators, people who run vaults. I just got back from Switzerland and met with the head of the world's largest gold refinery. He had great insights into, you know, who's selling, who's buying. We're talking about the physical gold here. We're not talking about all this paper gold. But in any case, Russia and China are behaving exactly the way we warned the Pentagon in 2009. Now, it doesn't mean the dollar is over tomorrow. But by the way, it's not just Russia and China, Iran, Turkey, other countries are buying gold. Kazakhstan has expressed interest in it. Kazakhstan is adding to its gold reserves. So this is going on. Now, the Russian ruble and the Chinese yuan are nowhere close to being global reserve currencies. They're, because a lot of people get confused about the difference between a reserve currency and a trade currency. Anything can be a trade currency. You can use baseball cards or bottle caps. It's just a way of keeping score in terms of trade deficits and surpluses. And governments settle up from time to time. And you've probably settle up in dollars for that matter. But to be a reserve currency, you need investable assets. You need a bond market across all maturities from 30 days to 30 years. You need repo mechanisms to finance them. You need a system of primary dealers. You need auctions, hedging tools, options, futures, settlement, clearance. You need all that plumbing of the bond market. You need a rule of law. You need a lot of things that China does not have and won't have for 10 years, and neither does Russia. So they're not ready to be a reserve currency, but there is another reserve currency waiting in the wings, which is the IMF special drawing right, the SDR. And that appears to be the play, because that could be rolled out a lot faster. In fact, it will be rolled out in the next global financial panic, because all the central bank balance sheets are stretched. You know, the Fed printed $4 trillion to deal with the last crisis, but they haven't taken it back. They haven't normalized the balance sheet. So what are they going to do in the next crisis? Print another $4 trillion, take the balance sheet to $8 trillion, leverage themselves 250 to 1? I mean, they look like a really bad hedge fund today. I think at that point, they'd be at the outer boundaries of confidence limits and unable to do that. But there is one clean balance sheet left in the world, and only one, which is the IMF. And functioning like a central bank of the world, they could issue these SDRs, these special drawing rights, and reliquify the world, which, by the way, would be highly inflationary and would be very bullish for gold. So, you know, look at all these scenarios, Eric, whether it's depression and deflation or reflation or panic cured by massive money printing in the form of SDRs, the devolution of the dollar as the global reserve currency, the rise of SDRs, you know, market uncertainty. It doesn't matter where you look. They're all bullish for gold in different ways. And my point is that, you know, don't go all in on gold. You never go all in on anything. You don't put 100% in anything. But investors who don't have 10% in gold are extremely vulnerable. Now, in fact, institutional investor allocations to gold are about 1.5%. When I was in Switzerland just a week before last, and I shared a limo from the airport out to the site where I was meeting. And the other fellow in the limo is the head of the Colombian government of Colombia's sovereign wealth fund. Basically, they have a pension fund for the citizens of Colombia, but unlike our pension fund, theirs is actually funded. It has real assets in it, and he manages that. It's about $60 billion. And I just said to him, I said, how much gold do you have? And he said, zero. So, you know, I talk about 10%, but in truth, allocations are about 1.5. If institutions simply move from 1.5 to 3, you know, just forget 10, forget 5. If they just went to 3%, there's not enough gold in the world at anywhere near these prices to fill that demand. So it looks like the setup is there for a super spike in prices. I'm not saying it's going to happen tomorrow. I'm definitely saying it's going to happen over the next several years. But the other problem is when it happens, you're not going to be able to get it. There are already physical shortages. Again, that's what I see that from a number of sources, but learned more about that when I was in Switzerland. So I recommend investors get your gold today, because when the price soars, you're going to be watching it on television. You're going to be watching it go up on television, but you're not going to be able to get any.
So you expect that there will be physical shortages that will not be resolved by price? Because normally for a commodity like this, if there's a shortage, the price just goes up.
Right, but there are certain physical shortages that, yeah, I mean, the price, you know, bid $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 an ounce. Pick your price point, but if there's no gold, there's no gold. See, you do have gold coming out of weak hands going into strong hands. It could go, there's just no offer. I mean, the strong hands are China, Russia. What if they say we're not selling? You know, U.S. can't sell. I explained that in chapter one of my book, The New Case for Gold. The U.S. cannot sell. For complicated reasons involving the relationship between the Treasury and the Fed and the need to maintain at least 8,000 tons of gold. Canada has no gold. The UK sold most of their gold. Switzerland just barely missed on a referendum to prevent future sales, but certainly the Swiss people have no appetite for selling. Germany's not selling. China's not selling. Russia's not selling. Mining output increases about 1.6% a year. So tell me where this gold's coming from. You know, look, maybe a central bank will be able to get some from the IMF. You know, the IMF has 2,000 tons, but retail investors are not going to be able to get any.
Well, I have plenty more questions, Jim, but unfortunately we're out of time, so we're going to have to leave it there. Before we close, The New Case for Gold is the name of the book. Is that available on Amazon now?
It's available on Amazon right now. It's actually ranked number one. And Amazon has a lot of subcategories, but two of them I watch. There's a subcategory called Money and another subcategory called Commodities. And right now the book is ranked number one in both categories. But it's the official publication date is Tuesday, but you can order it today. But that's an extraordinary ranking for a book that's technically not even out yet. It'll be out on Tuesday, but you can absolutely go to Amazon today and order it. And your copy will be in your mailbox or on your doorstep on Tuesday. And it'll be in bookstores on Tuesday also. But it's off to a good start. And thank you for mentioning it and inviting me on your program.
And I should mention for our listeners' benefit that this particular show was taped in advance, so the book is available right now as you're listening to the program. Nathan Egger will be joining me again as Macro Voices continues right after this.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Nathan Egger.
Eric, I loved listening to your interview with Jim. He's got this ability to weave together a cornucopia of topics, tie in a healthy dose of history, and make rational projections about the future. And my personal big takeaway from the interview was that the price of gold is going to be largely dependent on central bank policy. As you alluded to earlier, they're very likely to print money, which is going to be great for the price of gold. But in this interview, I had a hard time finding a mention of a scenario that would be bearish for gold. Maybe there isn't one. At least a bearish scenario in the intermediate to long term. Short term, sure. We've discussed many times on the program your own skepticism pertaining to gold's impressive rally year to date. So I'm curious, did your discussion with Jim do anything to change your outlook on gold?
Well, my outlook on gold is evolving. Jim's comments definitely had some influence, but I think it's really, you know, I've just reflected on the shows that we've done. I keep looking at the technical chart, and it really looks bullish. And I say that looks like a bullish chart, yet I'm still not buying it, and I can't put my finger on why. And I've done some just introspecting thinking about it, and I've realized the answer is I think that if you look back a few years, the most important thing to understand in macro was inflation or deflation. What's the trend? What's happening? The new inflation versus deflation is dollar rally. Are we looking at a dollar rally pause, or are we looking at a dollar reversal here? I think that that is the biggest issue in the entire market right now. I think it's driving everything, and I think that if Raoul Paul is right and we're looking at a dollar rally pause and the dollar rally is set to continue, that, by the way, has been my view, although I'm starting to open my mind a bit to the Axel Merck view that it might be over. If Raoul is right, I think gold is going to tank from here. I think that the low is not in yet. You know, if the dollar breaks notably above 100, I just don't see that we've got the reason for the recovery to occur yet. I do think it's coming. Your question was about intermediate to long term. I don't know how we're defining those. Long term, no question in my mind, bullish on gold. The question is short to intermediate term. I think short term, we got to see what happens at the 50-day here from a technical standpoint. But the really big question that I think you need to be most concerned about is, what do you think about the U.S. dollar rally? And I think my own take is, I can't decide. If I don't have strong conviction, I'm going to stay on the sidelines. Once I've come to a more firm conviction position on whether or not I'm really on board with Raoul that the U.S. dollar rally really is going to continue here, if I get more conviction on that or go the other way, start to take Axel's view and think that the dollar rally's over, then definitely time to get long gold. But I'm just not feeling it yet.
Gotcha. So after hearing Jim Rickard's macro backdrop for gold, giving us a little historical perspective, talking about the long-term future, what are we going to cover with Rick Rule next week? Why are we doing a second part, and what's going to be different exactly?
Well, Jim Rickards is a lawyer by training. He's a brilliant guy, great macro thinker, obviously does a lot of thinking about the role of gold in the macro economy and how it fits into the central bank reserve system and so forth. With all due respect to Mr. Rickards, I don't think he spends a whole lot of time in Mongolia in gold mines talking to gold miners about their conditions there. He is very much the city dweller, the macro thinker kind of guy. Rick Rule is the opposite. Think of him as your Indiana Jones kind of character. Rick is the guy who is constantly off to the next natural resource find, looking at some investment opportunity in a junior mining company in Eastover Shoe, Zimbabwe someplace. So he brings a perspective which is very much boots on the ground, and it's about physical resources from a physical resource perspective as opposed to from a macroeconomic argument as to why it makes sense in a portfolio perspective. I'm sure that Rick, who is a very smart guy, will also have plenty to say on macro, but I think of him really in terms of Mr. Boots on the Ground for natural resource investing.
Really looking forward to that counter perspective. So before we close, I know some of our listeners are probably wondering what happened to the quarter one issue of your free Peak Oil Investor newsletter. Can you just give them a quick update on what to expect?
I think that what to expect is going to be a little bit of a moving target because we haven't decided yet. So let's just open the kimono and be honest. I've got a limited amount of time. I've got a hedge fund to manage is what I do for a living in real life. I can only spend so much time. I feel that Macro Voices is going very well, and I think that we've gotten a lot of very positive feedback. The amount of time it takes me to write the newsletter versus, you know, do another episode of Macro Voices, I think we're accomplishing more doing this. We are leaning towards retiring the written newsletter and replacing it with this podcast for that reason. And to be honest, folks, I didn't write a Q1 letter because I realized it was April and said, oh, Q1's over. Oopsie. We've been too busy launching this podcast. We're probably going to retire it. I think for now, the policy statement is we're going to drop the Peak Oil Investor brand. We may reintroduce a written Macro Voices publication to kind of keep this new brand together at some point. But honestly, does anybody really still want my newsletter if you can get a weekly oral version, which is longer and more detailed? I know some people prefer written, but it seems like this is the better format. So I think our leaning is to retire the newsletter and just do the podcast, but we're definitely open to feedback.
So that's the plan, folks, and that's going to do it for us this week. But don't forget to tune in next week for part two of our special on gold featuring Rick Rule. I think you're really going to enjoy that. Please subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes, and if you have a spare moment, ratings and reviews are a huge help to us. You can follow us on Twitter at Macro Voices, and while you're at it, follow Eric directly at ERIKSTownsend. Drop by our listener forums at macrovoices.com/forums, where you can suggest future show topics, future guests, and pose questions for Eric, which we answer on the show from time to time. For Eric Townsend, this is Nathan Egger wishing you all a great weekend. We'll see you next time.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Nathan Egger, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.